Blog Talk Radio.
Exit. Yeah, and I'm coming to you from New York City. I'm going. somebody's calling it. I tell you what, I'm gonna go to a quick commercial to see who the heck is calling here on the line. Hold on a second.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy tale brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Yeah, well, I finished the brownies. Oh, God. I couldn't help it because you got to go to brownies.com. Aside from the best damn brownies, they had new ones that are enrobed in chocolate. They're truffles. In other words, they're calling them truffle brownies. So they're like brownies dipped in chocolate. Oh, God. And there's a raspberry swirl. There's a walnut and caramel. And the raspberry swirl is, like, totally outrageous. Anyway. So, let me get back to this. Actually, it was the first caller calling in to make sure he was going to call in. Okay. Of course, the problem is you call me on my home phone number. I can't answer it because I'm on the phone talking to all of you. Anyway, but he will be calling. It's his name is Vikas Khanna. What's it all about? You remember the whole thing? Gordon Ramsay's nightmare with those restaurants? Well, this one, it became a dream. Purnima Restaurant in New York City, and thanks to the executive chef, Vikas Khanna, this is really, place is doing quite well, and what he'll be talking about is specifically what Indian cuisine is all about. That's what we're going to discuss. What is Indian cuisine, what kind of spices are used, etc. Then we're going to have a sale of two titties. Tale of Two Cities. That's the Broadway show that I saw recently. And we're going to have Jill Santoriello, who wrote the book, the music, and the lyrics for this latest Broadway musical. That's the only way you can get me to get the Tale of Two Cities. I didn't want to read the book. Yeah, I know, it was required. I didn't want to read the book. Fuck the Cliff Notes. I went for the classic comic book instead. And How Things Haunt You, as it turned out. Well, I semi-read the book because I didn't realize until while I was watching the show that when I was in the movie Up the Down Staircase, I had some lines, and the lines were that I had to stand up and read a passage from the book. Of course, I didn't read the book and the movie either. So now I guess the only way to get to do it is to have me see the Broadway musical. Well, you know, it's the way it is. And speaking of theater, I guess there's a new play written called, I guess it's pronounced Zine Tapa, means Daddy is Coming. Okay, I won't say anything. It was written by Irina Aramea Bragan, and she'll be on, or Bragan, and she'll be on. The show is being performed at at Queens. Santa Claus is coming too, so. And it'll be at the Queens Theater of the Park at Flushing Meadow Corona Park, the famous Flushing Meadow Corona Park, where the first General Assembly was. That's right. Yes, it was not in Manhattan, while they were building the UN. This was where the first UN building was. It was a building left over from the 1939 World's Fair. And it's also where the Pact for Israel to become a state actually got signed there. Yes, a little bit of trivia. Who knows what the trivia will get you. Hey, try to remember that in case it's a question on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. You know, you just never know. A question came up that the guy missed on Millionaire. I thought I was going to go hysterical. And the question was about what in the province of Quebec, in Quebec cuisine, what is poutine, and it said something that you put gravy and cheese curds atop what, and they had, you know, the four answers there, and I think was something like I don't know, mushrooms was one of them, and fried eggs was one of them. And he decided it wasn't going to be French fries. And yes, it is French fries. That's poutine goes on top of that. I mean, that's what poutine is. It's cheese curds. Well, of course, people, heavens knows what they're cuisining it. Poutine cuisine, you know. Italian, I guess it would have been. Italian could put on the French fries a marinara sauce and mozzarella chunks. Yeah. Yeah, you can do it all over. Put all kinds of stuff on that. Yeah, yes, kosher one. Kosher one, I guess you'd put on, make a cream cheese sauce as for the gravy. Put a little bit of, you gotta put a little lox. Cream cheese sauce that has onions in it. And little pieces of lox on it. Oh, you could do all kinds of things. Maybe we'll figure out what you do for an Indian poutine. Indian poutine, French fries, and well, I guess there's the cheese that they make, fresh cheese that you make. Let's see, and for gravy, you could put the a masala sauce on top of it for the gravy. Wow, yeah. So, so that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And also, I'll get a chance in between. I got to tell you about this little event that I went to yesterday. Moms, dads, and grads, and there were all kinds of products. We'll be getting people on here to talk about the products because, here goes my house again, turning into a warehouse. I think I need to, I don't know, is it either eBay or just do a garage sale. But I have to put up a sign. If I do a garage sale, I'm going to put up a sign. I have the room. I need the money. Because, you know, with the garage sales, it was like people come over to you and they, no matter what price, they want to get it cheaper. I remember this. I can't help it. I did it one time. I remember there was this woman there. And she was like, I think I had like 20 pencils for a dollar or something. And she wanted to pay 75 cents. I said, sorry, the dollar. I mean, I think she just wanted to, you know, who knows. But anyhow, you're on the air. Vikas, are you there? No. Okay. Let's try this again. Let me see if I have him. Do I have Vikas here?
Yes, Lord. Vikas speaking. How are you?
Ah, there you are. Yes, I was just talking about Gordon Ramsay's nightmare. But let's talk about, I discussed that. Let's talk about what Indian cuisine is. What exactly, like somebody's asking.
That's a very, it's a very short question with such a long answer. That Indian cuisine is actually comprises of so much of not just Indian food, but also all the countries and the dynasties which ruled over India, their influence on the Indian culture and cuisine. It's such a vast cuisine, with extremely diversified. As you travel in India for maybe like 6 to 7 hours, the whole cuisine changes. Different use of spices, the different use of ingredients, it all changes, which is phenomenal because now you have so much a different variety. Now, as we come to this world of internet and technology, we have the opportunity to explore all these different cuisines being in one point, which is exceptional now.
Right.
Well, so I think that's what difficult thing about defining Indian cuisine now is it's becoming like more like American cuisine. It's such a huge melting pot of so many centuries of people's beliefs, food, ingredients, availability, and the time what people went through.
Well, let's first talk about, like, what are the typical, like, what are the, we'll go into, like, what kind of spices and what kind of sauces. So first let's talk about the spices that are used.
Most of the spices which are incorporated in Indian cuisine were all based on the fundamentals of Ayurveda. Ayur means science, life, and Veda means science. So it's a science of life, and this is a whole step which was written centuries ago of what spices to add in the food and what they actually do to metabolism, to our healing system, to our food, and to the nutrition values of food. And most common spices are cumin, cloves, black pepper, cayenne pepper, red chilies, green chilies. So these are very, very basic spices. You cannot incorporate or comprehend Indian food without these spices. Which is a great thing because now you get such a huge diversification of spices. And now cooking in New York, you can use them according to American palate in different proportions or ratios or people like.
So let's say, for instance, if you take a spice like cumin, cumin can come from different parts of the world, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so, would you find, let's say, that cumin, the taste of cumin could be different if it was imported from India or someplace else?
Not as much, as how old is the cumin.
Oh, okay.
The spices are very similar. I know the quality varies from country to country, depending on the region and the climate. But I would rather consider the major difference comes from the shelf life, like how long the spice has been sitting in your cabinet.
Okay.
It actually, you all start to get it dried up, and that's how it's a different flavor. It becomes more mild, but not as much as I see in the countries.
Mm-hmm. Now, when people talk about curry, now, curry is not a spice, but curry is a mixture of spices, correct?
Yes. Curry actually means a lot of Indian languages. It means the sauce too. The blend of sauces or the sauce or blend of ingredients as a sauce. So there's no right definition of curry as such. But one thing which is different to explain a lot of the Western countries is that curry is not a spice or a spice mixture. I think it's a British invention of this word, which has been so much over the years evolved in different terms. But for me, I still feel if I'm having chicken curry, it means chicken in a sauce. A very basic home terminology.
And so when you're making curry at your restaurant, what spices do you use?
Back to what I was explaining before was like the most interesting thing is that Indian cuisine is so diversified. If I'm doing a curry from Kerala, which is the south and a coastal region, I will be using a lot of coconut in making the spice. But if you're making a curry from north, we don't have any coconut. So, and it's just a very basic explanation of the curries, the variations of curries, and use of curry leaves, use of tamarind. Some curries from the south are extremely spicy. Or from Goa, we have the influence of the Portuguese culture, which lived over Goa for more than a century. So the curry will be totally variant as it travels around the country. So when I say a basic curry, it actually means a basic home-style curry for me is caramelized onions, cooked with tomatoes, cumin, ginger, garlic, cayenne pepper. That's a very basic curry for me, the most basic curry.
Now, what are the type of sauces that you make that are very indicative of?
The sauce which I make, the one sauce is a korma sauce, which is extremely mild, which is a base of onions, heavy cream, cashews, and peanuts. Many times I try to understand the dietary restrictions of people of not having nuts, so it's not to use any nuts in the curry. So it's actually basically a sauce of cooked onions, which onions as thickening agents, they work as a curry. That's a korma sauce. The chicken tikka masala sauce which you had at the restaurant, that is just basic tomatoes.
Right.
So there are no such, like, not a lot of ingredients which I put into my sauces because I actually want to, like, if I'm using a tomato-based curry, I really want it to taste like tomatoes. So I don't want to overpower it with use of too much of spices or peppers or anything.
So, okay, so let's get into some of the cuisine at your restaurant. For instance, let's talk about what are your signature. Let's go into your signature appetizers.
One of the very important appetizers which we do, which is one of the best sellers, are the lamb chops, which people do order as main course. They order as appetizers. We have French rack of lamb. What we do is we marinate it in yogurt and ginger and salt overnight. So the yogurt actually works as a tenderizer, and then we cook this in the big clay oven at a temperature of maybe 700 degrees Fahrenheit, which is very high temperature. So what it does is it actually sears, at this high temperature, sears the lamb from outside, and inside becomes extremely juicy. So this lamb chop, I mean, because of that reason, the high temperature, it's been very tender from inside and juicy, because we seal all the juices with a high temperature. And that's been a very important dish on the menu ever since.
Wow. Now, I had one, it was rice and cashews. Is that what else? What was in that?
That was a Kashmiri rice. Rice, cashew, and fruit. I know that's your favorite.
That was fabulous.
Thank you.
But then everything I've eaten at your restaurant is great. And I, said to you, you have the best Indian food I ever had, and I don't even like Indian food. I mean, good, you know?
I respected your honesty on that day. I really respected your honesty. I said, Mal, let me serve you food, and we talk about how much you like Indian food after that, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I want to get into some of the other dishes that you have, some ones that are not as common. Like, you know, I know what all, you know, most Indian restaurants, just about every one of them has the chicken masala, right? Chicken tikka
yes.
masala.
Yes.
Yeah, and also the tandoori. Explain what tandoori is to everybody, by the way.
Tandoor is a big clay oven, and you know, it's as history says, it was actually brought into India by the Arabs from Egypt. The Egyptians have a very similar way of cooking, in which they call it tandoor, so which explains why it's called tandoor, in which it's a big, it's cylindrical form of an oven in which the temperature, in the bottom of it, we burn the charcoal or the wood, and the temperatures can go up to 900 degrees Fahrenheit, which is very high temperature. The walls are made out of clay, which actually sticks onto the dough for us to make the bread.
So, and in the tandoori oven, that's when you're making. I saw one time, like when you make the bread, you're like slapping against the side of the oven, right?
I slap it on the inside walls of the oven, and because of the dough is very soft and it has a lot of water in it, it actually holds on. It's the position inside the clay oven, sticking onto the clay wall, and as it cooks, it becomes like it's easy for us to remove it.
Okay. Yeah, I always wondered about it. Why doesn't it fall?
because the water actually sticks onto the clay.
Now, also, when you have, like, when you're having tandoori chicken, it's always like it's that red and, well, what is it actually marinated in?
It's marinated in paprika, cayenne pepper, yogurt, cumin powder, coriander powder, lemon juice.
So in other words, let's say beforehand, like when you're prepping, the sauces or the for different things, right? Is that what
yes,
you do?
I make a thick marinade, and I actually soak the chicken inside this overnight.
Oh, okay.
So that is when it from inside too, you can taste the juices and, you know, the flavors of it.
And so let's talk about some other signature dish that's not as common. Is there a dish?
There's a very interesting dish which I have. It's shrimp panch puran. Panch means five, puran means spices. So it's a dish which comes from Bangladesh, and I'm crazy about this dish. It's a mixture of five spices, and we actually fry them, and then we fry the shrimp in that infused oil. So the shrimp really gets a very dense, earthy flavors from the spices. Then we add a little bit of onions, tomatoes, and we just cook it, let it cook. And it's a really very healthy and extremely light dish, which I really love.
And so that's your favorite shrimp dish that you...
It's a very famous shrimp dish.
Okay, and so we've gotten like a lamb dish, a shrimp dish. If you're choosing your favorite to cook, a chicken dish, what would that one be?
I used to do a tasting menu in which I could say I would take the breast of a chicken and stuff it with fig and spinach. Sauteed shrimp, spinach with onion, garlic, and fig. I'll just roll it up, I'll just tie it with the twine, and I'll throw it inside the marination of the tandoori chicken, which explains to you what it was, and then I'll put it in the clay oven. So it had this element of surprise. As you cut into the chicken breast, it had all these fillings inside. The figs were giving good texture and sweetness to it, and then you had the spinach, which is adding a very dense color to it. So I think that was an interesting dish for a long time on the menu.
Yeah, I tried that one too. That was great. That was really great. Now, one
Thank
of the
you.
Things I was surprised about is that you have beef dishes. Isn't that uncommon?
It's a little uncommon. It's not very common in India at all that Indian restaurants are serving beef. But, you know, in India, we have so much of different cultures and so much of different kinds of belief systems running the restaurants. If you go to a lot of restaurants which are owned by Muslims, you will always find beef on the menu. But when you come to America, one of the favorite meats of Americans is beef. And that's why we serve beef here, because we have a lot of demand of beef curries. People would ask us, would you like to a steak of different types? I was doing a lot of tasting, so I said, let's put it on the menu. So in a lot of Hindu restaurants, you will not, like, you know, owners are Hindu or they come from that belief system. But here, owner is Mr. Muhammad, who's from Bangladesh. So when you ask him, he's saying, let's put it on the menu if people have been asking about it.
Right. Okay, so now let's get into your desserts. I had a mango?
Kulfi. Mango ice cream.
Yeah, and you make that there, right?
I make everything in-house. It's a kulfi. Kulfi is an Indian ice cream which is very hard in texture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting because then it has to melt right on the palate and you have enough time to taste all the flavors you put inside. So this kulfi which you had, which you love, and a lot of people have that, they always eat that dessert in the restaurant. It's actually extreme high form cooked milk, in which I cook milk for maybe like 3 hours on very low simmer. So we evaporate all the milk, and then now you have a much solid milk. To that, I add mango purees and cardamom and pistachios. And then I freeze it in small containers.
Wow. That was really good.
Thank you.
One thing that I want so people would know, that you make your own cheese, right?
Yes, we make our own cheese.
Okay. Can you basically explain how one makes cheese?
Very simple, I'll tell you. What we do with the cheese, Indian cheese is always made fresh. So what we do is, we bring the milk to a boil, we add vinegar to it. What vinegar does, the acidity does, it separates the white from the solid. So you're removing the solid from white. So that's a liquid. So you put it in a cheesecloth, you remove all the solid from it, and then you press it and keep it in the shape. And that's how we make the cheese. It's that simple.
Wow. So you can use vinegar. I mean, like, is that the best thing to use? I mean, I know there's also, like, is it rennet, I guess? But I guess vinegar is okay then.
You can use rennet, you can use vinegar, you can use lemon juice, anything which produces acidity.
But you think, in terms of what doesn't leave a taste, you think, I notice, like, if I use lemon, it leaves a little bit of a taste of lemon. So I guess you're probably, like, you're better off with the vinegar, and it won't have
Vinegar does leave a taste, but so many times what does do it, that if I'm not using vinegar, it's a very good thing, because it's an aftertaste. But if I remove the solids with vinegar and I put the solids on a cheesecloth, I sometimes wash them, like, you know, I literally rinse it of cheese with fresh water. So it removes all the taste of acetic acid, which is vinegar, from the cheese, which I think is also interesting. Because now you have a cheese which is not cultured in a way, and now you can remove all the acidity from the vinegars and lemon juices.
And this is a cheese that you use, like, when you make this, that wonderful dessert, isn't there?
That's a similar thing. And then you poach that cheese in the sugar syrup. So in a sugar syrup, we actually poach those little patties. So that becomes like a dessert. It's a very popular dessert.
Right. So, it's absolutely a delight to eat at your restaurant, really. And everybody, I mean, you can go to www.purnimarestaurant.com, correct?
Yes, Merle. Nice. Always pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
I might have you on, another time to talk some more about
a little bit more about the food. But I appreciate you calling us and giving us some ideas. I'll pick your brain another time. Don't worry. Do you work for some other restaurants?
Yes, I work for the cafe at the Rubin Museum.
Uh-huh.
I have a restaurant, Tendu Palace, near the Wall Street. And I will look forward to speaking to you again and cooking for you at the restaurant. Thank you, Merle. Thank you.
I'd love to try the food at one of your other restaurants. We'll have to do something with that.
Okay, perfect.
Okay?
Okay,
all
Merle.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great evening, Vikas.
Bye-bye. Thank you for coming.
Bye-bye. Oh, yes. Talking food. I'm not going to go to a commercial. I'm not going to go to a commercial because I believe, let's see, I believe, do I happen to have Jill on the phone?
Yes, you do.
Oh, Jill Santorielli?
Santoriello.
Santoriello. I had introduced that you wrote the book, the lyrics, and the music for A Tale of Two Cities.
Yes, indeed.
Now, before I go into it, I know a lot of people look at me and I say, somebody wrote the book. And they go, you mean the novel? I say, no, there's a different terminology in the theater when you use the word book. So explain to my audience what book means.
It just means the script for the musical.
Okay.
So it used to be called a libretto as well, and now they call it a book.
Okay.
Just a little confusing, but...
Yeah. Well, I know, for instance, that let's say if I'm describing and I say it's like when you have the novel or the non-musical version,
right?
And I say I'm trying to think of Hello, Dolly, and I think the Matchmaker, I think, was the original.
Right, the Thornton Wilder play, right.
Right. So I would say, that Matchmaker is like the book for the musical Hello, Dolly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
okay.
this would be the play of the musical.
Right. Okay. So what? How did you go about obviously you have a novel to pull from.
Right.
But how did you decide on how to do? That's a lot to do. By the way, how did you go about doing this and choosing the dialogue? How did you do that?
Well, I adapted as much of the dialogue from the book as I could. I used as much of the Dickens as I could, and then a lot of the dialogue is original. And it's just, I was focusing on the character of Sidney Carton, which in the book is not really clearly the main character. But I felt that for a musical, we needed, a character that you could really focus in on and follow throughout the show. And so I developed him into being clearly the lead of our story.
Yeah. Which worked very well, by the way. I mean, when he sang, you listened. you guys also chose an excellent actor to do.
Oh,
it,
yeah, Jim is Jim is wonderful in the role.
Yeah, I remember listening to him. I have to tell you, one of the things I thought was, was he in Phantom of the Opera?
I don't believe he ever was.
He has that voice.
Yeah, I don't believe he ever played Phantom, but he'd be great.
Yeah. So now let's get into with the music and the lyrics. Now, doing both, usually you have one person, writing the music and one the lyrics. But
sometimes they split it into three people, but it's not that unusual to write the music and the lyrics. There's something funny about Dickensian adaptations for some reason.
Uh-huh.
When Oliver was done 40 some odd years ago, Lionel Bart wrote the book, The Music and the Lyrics. And when Rupert Holmes did The Mystery of Evan Drood, he also wrote the book, The Music and the Lyrics. So for some reason, Dickens' adaptations to musicals seem to be done more by one person for some reason or another.
Oh, it's because, just let everybody know, is this the first time that you're doing this for a show? I mean,
yes.
Okay. So
yes, this has been a labor of love for some time, and it was, you know, this particular story that I was just really hooked by, and it takes a long time to get a show to Broadway, so I've just, you know, basically concentrated on getting this one here.
Yeah, and so, in other words, have you ever written, like, any of those three things? In other words, have you ever done the book or the music or the lyrics for any other show? Or
Not for any other show that's been produced, no.
Oh, okay. So this is my first,
my maiden voyage.
All right. that's some task, I got to say. People have been like kind of saying that it's Les Mis-ish.
Well, we would be thrilled if it could be Les Mis-ish and lasting power and popularity, because I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Les Mis was a great show that millions of people, you know, have seen and loved. And I think the similarity to our show, hopefully from what we've been getting from the audiences, is that it really does reach audiences in a very emotional way, and they've just been loving it and coming back and seeing it again and again. That's been the greatest thing, is that we've only been running for a month, and I meet people outside the theater who've already seen it 10 times.
Really?
So that's just been really so gratifying, because it's just reaching something in people, and they're really responding to it. And Les Mis had that kind of pull as well, so we should be so lucky as to have that kind of success. We'd be very grateful.
Yeah, it's what I enjoyed about it was that it was an epic musical.
Right.
It's like, in other words, it doesn't have the tones of something like South Pacific or, you know, Oklahoma or any of the other, you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
The tone of it was very, it was almost like, to me, it was kind of as if I was going to Lincoln Center and seeing an operetta. You know what I'm saying? With dialogue. Yeah.
Well, like, I mean, because it is set in like a historical, you know, and kind of exotic period. So it has those kinds of qualities. It takes people to another place and time that, you know, that they don't ordinarily visit in their popular entertainment.
Yeah, in this story itself, is this historic versus, did Charles Dickens, like, not, I don't say totally made it up, did he, you know, adapt this into a book, or was this all true?
Well, he did a great deal of research about the French Revolution, because he was fascinated by that period and that event in history at the time. So he did a lot of research, and a lot of the things that he depicts happening in the book were based on actual historical events.
Okay, so in other words, all the characters, or how do they say that they are real? It's not.
Well, some of the things that happened in the story he based on history, but the actual story, I mean, it's really basically a love story set during the French Revolution, and those characters are all fictional and just came out of his imagination.
So let's I just realized that what we haven't talked about for my audience to hear, for anybody who happens to not read the book, doesn't know the story, tell us what the basic story of this whole thing is.
Well, the basic story, as I've distilled it in the adaptation, is it's about this young woman, Lucy Manette, who meets two very different men. One is this upstanding French nobleman who's rejected the aristocracy, and he's trying to find a new life in England. and the other is this cynical drunken lawyer who's kind of given up on life and love, and he meets this young woman and she rekindles something in him, and then along comes the French Revolution and draws them all back to France, and they're thrust into the middle of this, you know, historical event, and their lives are threatened, and so it's really about this love story fighting to survive in the midst of this terrifying event in history.
Okay. And so, well, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I think everybody probably knows it anyway. But
you'd be surprised at how many people don't know the ending and they're surprised in the show. It's really, another thing that's really interesting and fun, because they're like, oh my God, I had no idea that was going to happen.
So in other words, even though everybody knows the familiar quotes,
right?
You know, no one really knows who that actually came from.
Right, right. They don't necessarily know what it is he's referring to at the end of the book.
That's interesting. I didn't because I didn't read the book. Well, I was telling my audience before, when I grew up, I didn't like to read anything that wasn't conversational English. That was my thing, you know. And so I didn't enjoy, you know, Dickens or Shakespeare or, you know, any of that. And so I went after the classic comic books in order to get to, but which that was my thing. Get the classic comic books, and if it followed me in life, because and as I was saying, the coincidence happened to be in the movie Up the Down Staircase.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the movie, the book, they're reading from the book A Tale of Two
right.
Cities, which in the book version itself, by the way, it's referred to as A Tale of Two Titties. And I never forgot that. And every time, like, as soon as this comes up, I have to remember to pronounce it correctly, because that was always in my head. And because I had... And then what happened is that, coincidentally, I wound up in the movie. And of all things, one of the things I had to do is that this teacher calls on me to read a passage from the book, A Tale of Two Cities.
You got to be careful.
Yeah. And I... So, you know, it followed me anyway. I sort of got to read it anyway, but didn't. But it's a magnificent play. I mean, it's fresh in terms of it's bold. It's keeping you awake. It's a bit lengthy. I have to say that. It's definitely lengthy.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, and I'm curious as to when you found, in terms of audience, did you find any young audiences coming to this?
Oh yeah, the students have been amazing. It was something that I never actually anticipated or expected, because when I started working on this project, I was like 18 years old, which was a long time ago, and I was kind of a strange kid, and I really didn't think that anybody else was interested in what I was interested in, and I was off by myself working on this, and now it's taken all these years to get here, and the most gratifying thing is seeing all these high school students, you know, kids who were my who are my age when I started working on this, and they've just been loving it, and they also have been amongst the audiences that are coming back again and again. So there's something about this story that really speaks to kids, and it's really nice to have a young audience, because it's thought of as a classic, and people are maybe thinking that it's dusty and not hip and not something that kids would respond to, but they really are responding to the love story and the message, you know, which is about redemption and being able to take control of our own lives and make things happen. So that's really speaking to kids.
Well, I'm glad. I'm really glad to hear that. I guess, but you know, I guess like given a choice, I suppose if I was in this situation, given the choice of, you know, reading the book or seeing the musical on Broadway, it's really funny. This whole running thing about me and reading. I hate to read. I'm a journalist, and I skipped 2 years of school.
So you must be smart.
It's like, tell me anything. Just tell it to me, educate me, whatever you say, I'll absorb. Don't make me read it, though. That was kind of my attitude. But that's why I enjoy going to the theater and so much, because it's, you know, I can see it, it's performed. So you said it took you all these years, like you, so you started actually working on, what did you work on first when you started thinking about this, the book?
It started with the music, actually. It always started with the music. I write music first.
Uh-huh.
And it just began as a few songs inspired by the book, and it was just a hobby. And then as the years went on, I was working in the entertainment business, and I decided to devote full time to it and wrote the show, but then really didn't know where to start as far as getting it produced, because I didn't have connections, and I didn't have the money, of course. You have to raise a lot of money to get a show to Broadway.
Right.
So it took me many years until I just basically got really, really lucky and ran into my two young producers who were looking for a first-time project for themselves as the production, and we just teamed up and you know, they took the ball and ran with it, and they did this amazing thing and raised all this money and got us to Broadway against all odds.
Oh, I'm certainly glad they did. So in other words, so when you started, so you started writing the music. In other words, you had to, of course, thought of like what the dialogue sort of would be in order to write the music, correct?
Yeah.
Because
some of the language in the book can be a little difficult. I mean, it is 150 years old, but there is still, you know, a lot of material that could be used. And I took some of the lyrics, you know, directly out of the book and really tried to stay as faithful to Dickens' words as I could in many of the songs. And then some of the other songs and scenes just came out of my head, you know, in trying to tell the story and focus it on Carton. So hopefully it's not too clear where Dickens leaves off and the rest begins.
Right. In terms of the songs, do you have any, like any, what would you say are the ones, let's say, that you found like stood out, like people, I don't know, these days nobody's walking out of the theater singing any particular song. It really has to be something, you know, either warped or something for people to actually remember the song.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I think you just need a little bit of repetition before melodies stick with you. It's not usual that you walk out of a show the first time hearing something and can really recall anything. But hopefully within the experience of being in the show, you know, the music is written to be experienced live with
right.
the story.
Which songs, though, do you think did you find as, like, getting feedback? Which songs?
Well, my favorite song for many years has been one that Carton sings called I Can't Recall. And that the nice thing has been that seems to be the song that gets the biggest audience response as well. But we had a concept CD out for many years, and that song isn't even on there. It's really only kind of come to the fore in the last year when we did our first production and now on Broadway. But that song seems to really get the strongest audience reaction. And there's another Carton ballad called If Dreams Came True that people seem to like a lot as well.
And are you using either of them for the, like, when they're doing the commercial for it, or, you know?
Actually, we haven't used a lot of singing on the commercials yet, because there's, you know, copy being spoken and there's a lot of images and stuff. But, say, when, you know, Jim did Broadway on Broadway in Times Square, where everybody performs from the shows, and he did sing I Can't Recall in Times Square a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's You know, it's not like there's a lot of songs in the show that can really be taken out of context out of the show. They're really very specific to the story and the characters.
Right.
But that was one that we've done out of context.
And I can't recall, just to tell us basically what, you know, that's about. Let's, you know, my audience.
Well, that's about Sydney Carton, who, again, is this cynical, dissolute lawyer who doesn't believe in much of anything, and he encounters this very warm, very forgiving young woman and Christmas Eve, it happens to be, and she, you know, she reaches out to him and she invites him into her home and into her, you know, family world, and he's very touched by this because he hasn't been, you know, people haven't necessarily been so inviting to him in the past, and
right.
And it changes him, and he's a little drunk, you know, at that time. He's been having some Christmas cheer, and he's not really sure whether it's you know, the alcohol or the experience that's moved him, but he kind of looks up and sees the world in a different way, and that's what the song is about.
Yeah. It'll be interesting, of course, to see. You know, what I notice about with the Broadway shows is as the shows go on, like when singers go, you know, they go to, you know, do their cabaret act,
mm-hmm.
Which song they choose to sing, you know, which songs like become famous, and part of it is because they're singing it.
Right.
You know, they seem to be all choosing one particular song because it's the most dramatic, or it's, you know,
mm-hmm.
it does great for their range or things like that, and it may not be the favorite song you wrote.
Well, it's funny, an actor just asked me last night, an actor asked me backstage if he could get a copy of I Can't Recall because he wanted to sing it for auditions and you know, other cabaret, exactly what you're talking about. So that's nice to have them actually ask for the song that you like.
Yeah. When do you think, did you start going into the studio yet and, you know, to make a CD?
We're planning on that. We don't have an exact date yet, but we're hoping to do that in the next couple of months. Yeah, do an original cast album.
That's great. You know, I would love to meet you.
Oh, I would love to meet you too.
I didn't get a chance. I'm not on the A list. You know that list. That list.
What is that? What is the A list?
You know,
I don't think I'm on it either.
You know the A list. In other words, when I get to review shows, it's like you get to be on the A list. I don't. You know, they got to get voted in and all this other stuff. And if you're on the A list, then you get to see, like, you can go opening night or second nighter
uh-huh.
or first night review or something like that. So I've never been able to make the A-list. It's, I won't go into why. No matter how many shows I've reviewed and how many years I've been reviewing. But so it's every once in a while. So if I can get the, you know, the PR company to let me do it, I go. But I didn't have a with Judy Jacksina, there wasn't a problem at all. Although I didn't rate going to the opening night party, but
I could barely get into that. I had to sneak in.
Although I don't know if I would have wanted to be there, you know, for that kind of thing. But I would like to. I guess I'll have to ask Judy, huh, to invite me back so I can come
back.
Yeah,
let's make a date.
Yeah. Shall I ask Judy? I'll ask
sure.
you. I'll tell her you said so. How's that? No, I would like to meet you because it's also not as common to have a woman.
That's right, girl power.
Yes, and this is very important. This happens to be my thing about empowering women.
Mm-hmm.
I do that all the time. I actually do public relations for the New York Sharks women's tackle football team.
Oh, I love that.
Believe me, I have done things past nobody else has done.
Now, if it was
so,
a touch football team, I'd ask if I could join. But tackle.
No, this is real tackle. although we did, we were sent up for a tournament in Canada for flag football, of all things. We were actually chosen, the only U.S. team chosen.
Yeah.
But that's
great.
You know, reputation. But anyway.
Where do the Sharks play?
In Brooklyn.
Cool.
Come to think of it, okay, I'm going to get back on this particular thing. We're having an event. This is on the 13th at the Sports Museum of America.
Uh-huh.
It's during the day. It's Columbus Day. I'm just going to let you know. I mean, I'll get back to I would just like to invite you because I'd like you to see all these empowered women.
Following each other.
And I will introduce you. Believe me. And I think the media is going to, I'm sure the media is going to be there for this thing. Well, we're getting, I'm making sure that a relic, that there's a donation of a jersey. You know how you always go to places and there's always somebody's jersey.
Right.
Well, I decided I wanted the owner of the team, I wanted her retired jersey. She stopped playing at the age of 45.
Good for her.
So we're going to do an event that I'll tell you about.
Well, I'm 42, so maybe there's still time for me.
Oh, there is. Oh, we got players in the 40s, in our 40s. We really do. I mean,
I'm a huge football fan, so that's pretty cool.
Then you definitely, I'm going to invite you to a game.
I would love that.
I definitely will. I'll invite you to a game. It's on me. Yeah, I'll have you come to the game. You'll be quite surprised, and maybe. I'm sure the show will continue into next season. Your show.
We certainly hope so.
So what we can do, we can actually during halftime play a song from your show. Put that right in during halftime. That would be so cool.
We have to think hard, long and hard about something that would be appropriate for a football game.
Oh yeah.
I'm sure there's something.
Yeah, we'll figure something. If dreams come true, you know. I'm going to get back with you on this. As I said, I'd love to meet you backstage. And I might have you back on again.
That would be great.
Yeah, because I also at some point would like to talk basically some basic things about the theater, you know, and I'm sure I can pick your brain.
I'm sure
you can contribute, you know, I'm proud that, you know, to have that a woman is doing this, you know, the whole thing that, you know, all three things and it shows great. It's a, you know,
you
did a good job. Oh, I have to write the review in next week's paper. Thank you. My review will be out in the Queen's Times
Great! I can't wait to read it
next Thursday. Yeah, and I'll even talk about this interview because I think that's a good. I think for me, commonly, you know how reviews go. You know what I mean? But I think I'd like to give a little bit of focus on you. Versus the show, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to get it an aspect of the show, which I think will be, everybody else is writing the review, just saying it's great, go see it. Now let's
tell you
something.
Yeah, no, please say that.
But that'll be in it. Yeah, I always, what I look at is when I'm seeing the shows is now like you're paying $100. Is it worth it? Can you see it? Do you have to sit in the front? Can you see it from a different place? Can you, things like that. That's how I kind of look at it. But there is some theater I've seen that I've walked out from. Not too money, but, you know, like I'm going, this is really bad. And I've also found, and this is really terrible, I'll write a review, and I'm finishing writing a review, and I'm looking at other people's reviews, and I'm going, did we see the same show? And the problem is not because it's not because I think the show is bad. See, I'm giving praise to the show, and I'm going, what did they see? Because when I look at, and I'm sure you agree with me, when we're looking at a show, it's a piece of entertainment. Stop looking at whether the show was done before, comparing it to the book,
comparing it.
You know, that's what people tend to do. They compare. Don't compare. Just go.
Yeah.
Don't even, I'm not going to assume everybody saw Les Mis. So why say it's Les Mis-ish?
Right.
You know? And
yeah,
you know,
you should just look at things on their own merits, absolutely.
Yeah, just to see it. I mean, it's basically what I would say more, how I was an opera with dialogue. That's how I kind of see it. That's me, you know, how I'm seeing it. And it's good. You know, you're not no one's singing, you know, at the top of their lungs and, you know what I mean, opera style.
Right.
You know, but...
Yeah, to me, it's a very traditional musical, you know, it's a book musical, it's not an opera because it's not sung through.
Yeah, that's the word. It's traditional musical. That's probably the kind of term that I'm going for, yeah. So people, although... with what's going on, I don't know if people know what traditional musical is. But I'll get it passed. I'll get it through. I'll explain. So, all right. I appreciate you calling in. Thank you very much for having me. This is so great. What I probably do once the CD comes out, I can go back onto the all of these shows are archived. So I can go back on it and fix up the description so that it will link it to people being able to buy the CD.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. So in the meantime, Jill, it was wonderful. It's great talking with you. And
thank you so much. You too.
And you're very talented. Have a great evening. Have a great show.
You too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you're picking a show, coming to New York and you're choosing a show, it's of epic proportions. I mean, it's long. I'm not going to, say that it's not, but it's long, but it's good. You know, I mean, it's theater, it's classical musical theater. I guess that's how it would kind of say it. I know that, and I can really understand. I can understand students appreciating it, because it's a whole different feel than, having to read a book, for English, that kind of a thing. So I'm going to take a break with a couple of things here. First, well, before I go to a commercial, I'm in the mood for a song. Let's see. I need something. Let's see. What do we got here? I have to do, let's see. All right, let's just take a quick commercial break before we have our next guest.
Thank you for calling JetBlue. May I help you?
My cousin was telling me you guys have extra legroom.
Uh-huh. We have extra legroom as compared to a normal coach seat.
Okay. If I don't have an extra leg, can I use that room for something else?
No. That is not what the extra leg implies. We took out one whole row of seats, and that gave the rest of those rows a couple of extra inches of legroom.
Ah.
I understand what you mean. The words extra leg imply that, but it has nothing to do with having an extra leg.
I'm a pretty literal person.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be taking it very literally.
I guess a little too literally.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with?
I think that's it. You've been pretty helpful.
Thanks for calling JetBlue.
Dear traveler, stretch out. We now have the most legroom in coach. Visit us at JetBlue.com. Sincerely, JetBlue, based on average fleet-wide seat pitch of U.S. Airlines.
Yeah, and by the way, JetBlue just recently opened their new terminal at JFK. I want to go there. I have to take a flight. I'd like to see how how smoothly this whole thing goes. You can see a whole description. I have an article in the Queens Times. So if you go to www.queenstimes.com, it's in it's not this week's article, Thursday. It's last Thursday's article. And you'll be able to, you'll probably enjoy JetBlueing even more. And speaking of Queens, Queens Theater in the Park is where a new show is being featured. And the play is called, Vine Tata? Is that how we pronounce it?
Vine Tata.
Vine Tata.
Vine Tata. and I think you pronounced it very well.
Oh, okay.
Hi.
Hi. This is, we have Irina Bragan. Is it Bragan or Bragan?
No, you pronounced it perfectly. Irina Bragan.
Oh, good. Look at that. I got 2 for 2.
Well, I can teach you a few more words in Romanian if you'd like.
I wanted to share something with you that's interesting. I was trying to locate relatives and to see who else, came here from where, into
uh-huh.
the United States. And I keep hearing, it's like every time I ask about, it's always hard to search your mother's side, how that is.
That's
right. So I was asking on that side, and I was trying to get some information. I always kept on hearing, they would say, I'm not sure, they either came from Germany or Romania. And I'm going,
oh, well.
So, but the interesting thing was that when I, in trying to locate somebody, I got, the cousin of this person. And she said to me that that the guy's parents came from Romania. What I was trying to link was, because of his life, the guy was an actor many years ago.
Oh.
And, his name was Sid Tomac.
Uh-huh.
And he was an actor. And I was trying to figure out, because as I looked up some information, it wasn't like the name he chose for show business. That was his name. So I was trying to figure out, where does Tomac come from? I heard some last names of grandparents or whatever, and I was trying to get where the Tomac is from. But they're saying that
you have to come to our play and then get in touch with a little bit of your Romanian roots.
I guess so. But so tell us, first of all, is this the first play you've written?
No, I have written several plays, but Vine Tata is the first full production that I've had. I've had a number of staged readings of this play in Los Angeles. I'm from Los Angeles. And I've had several staged readings here also at Queens Theater in the Park. The play was chosen as part of the Immigrant Voices Project, which is led by Rob Urbanati. And it was chosen from a number of other submissions throughout the country. And we had a staged reading several years ago, and we had a wonderful response from the audience. And so the theater decided to continue to work on developing the play. So this is the first full production. And I'm very excited. It's a wonderful production. We have a wonderful team of great director Tom Rowan, who has fought very hard for 2 years to get the play produced, and wonderful, wonderful actors. The play is about the reunion between a Romanian former prisoner of conscience, a man who was really a hero, who stood up to communism at a time when it was very dangerous. He was a man who had a very high position in the government and led a very privileged life, but realized that his country was going to pot and that the government that he was part of was a lie. So he stood up against the regime. And the consequence of that was that his wife and his family were persecuted, and he had to lose his family as a result. So the play is set in 1990, after the revolution in Romania, when Tata, the father of the family, is finally allowed, after many years of prison, to go to California and see the daughter that he had been separated for 25 years. And she has very mixed feelings towards him because, on the one hand, he's a hero. He's a man who stood up for his ideals. But on the other hand, those ideals cost her her childhood and cost her growing up with a father. So the play is about this issue of a conflict that all of us have in our lives. You don't have to live in communism in Romania to have this kind of conflict, the conflict between survival and principles. And it's about the cost of principles and why principles are still important. So the play is really set in California, in Los Angeles, and it's the story of the meeting of these two people and a contrast of cultures. Someone coming from a country where he's suffered the consequences of a terrible government, of people not standing up for their beliefs, a country that's been destroyed by that. And coming to the United States and meeting his daughter and awakening his daughter to the importance of standing up for her ideals. And she finds out that in her own world, there are issues that she needs to take a stand on and she needs to take a risk. And so the story is about that conflict between these two values.
Okay. Now, is any of this personal?
Some of it, yes. A good portion of it is personal. Particularly, it's a memory piece, and the background of the story is personal, and it's based on a book, actually. It's a dramatization of a book that I wrote called Subterranean Towers, a father-daughter story. The personal part is the true story of my own father, who was the general and vice secretary of state in Romania and was a very important man in the government, and who actually was the first member of the Communist Party to stand up against the very government that he was a part of. And he wrote a book in which he told the truth about communism and its failure and the hypocrisy of it. And for writing this book, he was sentenced to 25 years. And he was in solitary confinement. And my mother, on the other hand, was a very successful actress in Romania. And when my father took this stand, he basically ruined her career. As a result of this stand, she was thrown out of the theater. We, my brother and I, were persecuted. We suffered a great deal. And later, a number of years later, we were able to leave and come to the United States. So that part is autobiographical. There's another part of the story which has to do with the contemporary life in Los Angeles and the life of a family where teenagers are growing up in an environment where ideals are not so important, and where it's an environment of cynicism and a lack of belief in heroes, and the meeting between the teenage granddaughter of this man and this very idealistic man. That's something that I developed and worked on. And so some of it is based on fact and some of it is based on just observation and fictionalized, yeah.
So now, the play didn't begin yet, right? Is it starting this weekend, this Saturday?
Yeah, the play is starting. The play is starting. Actually, starting tomorrow night,
Okay.
And it's going to be playing for 3 weeks. We have basically Saturday and Sunday are pretty much sold out. There's still tickets available for Friday, and then I think we're fairly open for the next couple of weeks. I think if people are interested, they need to go online to www.queenstheater.org and get tickets. And I think it's a play that's full of, there's a lot of drama, but there's also a lot of humor. And there's a lot in the play about contemporary life and the issue of teenagers and the relationship between teenagers and their grandparents. I think that a lot of people who saw the play when we had the reading at Queen's Theatre in the Park, no matter, you know, what culture or background they came from, could relate, particularly to the relationship that develops between Eon, this very wise and soulful man who's really experienced life and who really has strong beliefs, and his granddaughter, who's a teenager growing up in this very fast culture and who starts developing a kind of new understanding of life through this relationship with her grandfather. So I hope that that you'll come in and your listeners will as well and join us.
Yeah, well, I want to, just so people understand, because this is not local radio, that Queen's Theater in the Park, at Flushing Meadow Corona Park, there is a theater. So, you know, like if you, I guess it's...
It's not in the park. It's a beautiful theater, and it's very, very, it's a theater that's gone, that's... is in Shea Stadium, it's gone through
Shea
great
Stadium. Actually, if people wanted to, the recognition has come from the movie Men in Black.
Okay.
Because, like, when they see that tower in Men in Black that they...
Exactly.
And that's where the Queen's Theater in the Park is, right there. Of
right.
Course, I don't think that in the movie you actually could see the theater. I don't think you see that, but that's where it is, which, in the 1964 World's Fair, that was the New York State Pavilion.
Right. It's a wonderful theater because it has a great program of development for new plays, and particularly the Immigrant Voices Project is allowing many, many new voices and playwrights to be expressed. And I think, the audience, the theater really chooses plays that I think people can relate to basically in their own lives. And I think that's why, you know, they're usually packed in, you know, full houses. I think that's one of the draws of this particular series and all the plays that are picked at Queen's Theater.
Yeah, because I know that, I think this weekend also Kevin, the Bacon Brothers are going to be there.
Right, right.
So there's all types of, there's two theaters
Right.
Theater.
This is a studio theater. This is an
mm-hmm.
intimate theater, and that really fits for this play because it's a family play. It's has six actors, and it creates a very intimate, close feeling. And then the larger theater, there's the larger shows, which are very exciting, too.
Well, I'm hoping to, I don't know if I can make it this weekend, but I'll try to get there at least next weekend, because I would love to see, you know, after talking with you, now I want to actually see the show.
I hope so. I hope I get to meet you.
And by the way, on... If you go to the website of Blog Talk Radio, you can actually, when people click on, they're actually going to see the book. And you
right.
Can actually,
Subterranean Towers, A Father-Daughter Story. The book is about basically the way that two people, a father and a daughter, survived very difficult circumstances. By using their imagination. My father was in prison in solitary confinement and for many years, and yet he was able, in these terrible circumstances, to write poetry in his mind, to have conversations, Morse code conversations, with an astronomer next to him, to basically play symphonies in his mind, to create imaginary music. He actually wrote a book in his mind called Subterranean Towers, which is about the hidden power that's in each of us to survive difficult circumstances. And the book goes back and forth between his voice as the father growing in prison, using his imagination and his internal strength to survive, and then my story as a child growing up in this, what I call the greater prison outside my father's prison,
mm-hmm.
Which is a prison of Romania, persecuted by other children, and by teachers and by everyone who basically said, you know, you're a convict daughter and go away, and, you know, being ostracized in the society because we had broken the rules. And also using my imagination and literature and stories as a way to escape and to create a better world. One of the issues that I develop in the book and in the play as well is how important the imagination is and how important it is that the imagination is nurtured by positive voices. In the play, there's a teenager who has a very, very hard time dealing with problems in her life because there's no positive nurturing voices that help her out. And
I
grew up with great literature and great stories, and that's what really helped me to survive, you know, those difficult circumstances. So the book is about that. It's a very uplifting book, and I hope people will read it as well.
Good. Hopefully I'll get to the show next week.
That's
and
great.
and I'll get to meet you.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate you, you know, you coming on the show to talk to us about this. It's always nice to have some, you know, new people, women power, as I say. I just had Jill Santoriello, who wrote the book Lyrics and Music for A Tale of Two Cities, the Broadway show A Tale of Two Cities. I just had her on. So and here we had again. It's unusual that you'll have a woman that's doing all the three things, you know, for a Broadway show. So just now we have continued with the trend, and you're right. You wrote the script for this play. I hope it does well.
Well, thank you very much.
And I hope like it goes. I guess it. Well, it's probably if you say it's like if it's set for an intimate play. Then you got to get the right spot. I mean, sometimes going Broadway doesn't work. You know what I mean?
Well, I hope it will eventually make it to Broadway.
Well, you can always turn it into a musical.
Well, okay. Well, come and see it.
Yes.
And
okay.
I hope we will get to meet. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're quite welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye, Rena. So, yeah, Queen's Theater in the Park, help people, like, when they come to New York, that they go see a show there. It's really nice. It's, the whole park is nice.
Yes, very, very nice.
Yeah. So, well, I'm going to actually end my show a little early, 6 minutes early. So, again, thank you so much, and thank, you know, everybody for listening. You know, when you come to New York, go to Pranima Restaurant, go see A Tale of Two Cities, and if you're around, at least in the next couple of weeks, see Vinay Tata.
Vinay Tata, Daddy's coming.
Right. Over at Queen's
you will
Theater
laugh and you will cry.
Okay.
I promise you that, and you will not be bored. There really isn't a dull moment in the play. It's a very exciting play that moves very quickly, and really, the audiences that have seen it in the past have said that it just really went to their hearts. So
good. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
So. I am going to, well, all right. You know, it says like I have a few minutes left. Let me play. I'm up for Josh. Let's do Josh Groban. And we'll go.
darkness, I can see your light, and you will always shine, and I can feel your heart in mine. Your face I've memorized, I idolize just you. I look up to everything you are. In my eyes you do. Time changes everything. One truth always stays the same.